out in this one direction, they know it would be out there if it's there. That's the theory, Dick. Imagine a bunch of planets in the Kuiper Belt, you know, all being, you know, sweeping out in the same, you know, all elliptical and all sweeping out in the same direction. So that's the scenario. The only way that could happen is, they said, 0.007% of the chance of all of them winding up in that type of a location. Type of orbit, I guess. Back to you, Dick. WS2X.
Now, if you took your globe and carefully divided it into 1 degree squares, near the North Pole and the South Pole, it's very difficult to do, but if you did it accurately, the answer is 41,253 degrees, approximately. If you want the exact number, take 360 degrees, square it, divide by pi. So 360 squared divided by pi gives you 41,252.96. Be a little more exact. Square degrees on the surface of the sphere. So if you and I are aiming our telescope and we're going to find out how long it's going to take to find something, your first question is, okay, your telescope is set to scan how many degrees of the sky at once? How much are you moving it? How sensitive is it? There's a whole bunch of questions that once you answer those questions, you can calculate that you're going to find it in a day, or 10 years, or 1,000 years. 41,253 square degrees. That's a lot of area. The moon and the sun both are 1/2 degree horizontally, 1/2 degree vertical. So you could put four moons, or four suns, into 1 square degree of the sky, and there's 41,253 of them. A sobering thought to tell you how much of a needle in the haystack are you looking for. Let me drop.
Didn't the name of each square degree, doesn't it have a name that began with the letter S? I'm trying to think what it is, Dick. It escapes me. The letter S, like Sierra.
Yeah, you're talking about steradians. Now, most astronomers don't break up the sky into square degrees. They break it up into steradians. One radian is 53.7 degrees, I think it is. So if you take a chunk of sky, 53.7 degrees in azimuth, 53.7 degrees in elevation, that square on the spherical surface, I think, is 1 steradian. And so there are four pi steradians on the surface of a sphere. 4 pi. And that's the main reason why a high number of the formulas with reference to antenna analysis are a whole bunch of terms divided by 4 pi. The gain of an antenna is 4 pi a over lambda squared. That's the gain, an area is gain lambda squared over 4 pi. An awful lot of the antenna formulas contain 4 pi, because that's the number of steradians. The pure mathematicians don't measure angles in degrees, they measure angles in radians. Let me drop. And 1 radian is 180 degrees divided by pi. And I think it's 53. See, I can actually do it here. Got my calculator out. 180 divided by pi. Convert that to a number. 57.29 57. Let's call it 57.3. So 1 radian is 57.3 degrees. And so a square with those dimensions is a steradian. So they measure things in radians and steradians. Is that the number, is that the word you were looking for, Paul? Go ahead.
Yes, steradians. I forget what it is, it just escaped me. Spending so much time on studying all these rockets and how much thrust they all got, and I'm getting away from the astronomy. What are you going to do? But, you know, I think of Alan Shepard, you know, it's named after Alan Shepard. It's called the New Shepard, this rocket by Blue Origin, and Alan Shepard's rocket, the Redstone rocket, had like, you know, a little under 80,000 pounds of thrust, and he went up higher than this rocket did. But there's a difference in fuel and type of fuel that they have. And, this rocket has got more power, 110,000 pounds of thrust. It didn't go as high. But there's a difference, you know, you have a longer rocket, you can have a stretched tank, and you can get up more fuel. And that's really the difference. But it's amazing that here's this guy, private company, 110,000 pounds per square inch, compared to what the government did back in the early 1960s with 78,000 pounds of thrust. We've come a long way here. This private guy doing this and then landing it back on Earth. Alan Shepard wound up in the ocean after 15 minutes. Now this guy's setting it up for tourists. You know, he wants people to go, you know, suborbital. I don't know. Would you pay for big money for a suborbital flight? I don't think so. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, you and I are practical people, Paul, and so we're not likely to do that. John's not likely to do it either. But there are people out there with a very adventurous spirit who will gladly go and do that. They got the money. It's an exciting thing to do. And they go base jumping, bungee jumping, skydiving, and a space flight. Is it 100 kilometers? It's considered the beginning of space, 62 miles, something like that. By the way, whenever you're measuring an antenna pattern of an antenna, you and I tend to swing the antenna in azimuth and maybe swing it in elevation, and we draw a plot. That gives you a little bit of the picture. Every antenna that has ever been produced, let me drop. Make believe the antenna is a miniature object in the center of a globe, and that antenna that you're testing is lighting up every bit of the surface of that globe to some degree. Every antenna really transmits across all 41,253 square degrees. Every antenna does that. So if you really want to know the gain and directivity antenna, you've got to evaluate what it's doing across all of that 41,000 square degrees. Astronomically speaking, the sun and the moon are extremely large objects. When it comes to celestial objects, essentially nothing is bigger as a single object. Yeah, there are galaxies that are bigger in angular extent, but when it comes to a point source object, the sun or the moon is about the biggest thing you're going to see from planet Earth. But because they're only half a degree wide and half a degree high, you can fit four of them into one square degree. There are 41,000 square degrees in the surface of the sphere, and you could put four of them in each one of those square degrees. So 41,253 divided, multiplied by four, is 165,000. So if the Earth, if the sky was packed as tight as it could be packed with either moons or suns, they're all edge to edge, there'd be 165,000 of them. And those are the biggest objects that you and I can think of that we see out in the sky. Obviously, stars and planets, particularly stars, are in general so small that you see the light out of each of those stars. There's 10 to the 22 stars in the observable universe. 10 to the 11 stars per galaxy, 10 to the 11 galaxies, or 10 to the 22 stars. You can easily ask a person, how many stars do we see? Let me drop. It's really a trick question. See, the light, in theory, of 10 to the 22 stars. Only one star that we see. It's called Sun. Our local star. We can see that star. All other stars, till very recently, we don't have the ability to look at the detail of that star. It's a point source of light. And we're slowly getting to the point where we're going to have big enough telescopes that we're going to start seeing the details of that star. Does it have sunspots? Does it have planets? We've got a long way to go. Those are extremely small objects and an extremely large number of them. I think it's Alber's paradox was that, hey, if you can see to infinity in all directions and the sky is filled up with stars, why isn't the whole sky white at nighttime? Let me drop.
Don't forget, Dick, a lot of those stars don't exist anymore, but we're still seeing them.
Yep, some of them have become supernovas and now a great big patch of jazz scattered over a whole lot of sky. If the star was 1,000 light years away and 900 years ago it blew up, we don't know about it yet. There's quite a few of those. But space is so empty. That's the reason why the sky is not white at nighttime. It's really empty.
How did they disprove that, Dick, that theory?
When you say that theory, meaning Alber's paradox, why is the sky not white at nighttime? Is that the question you're asking, your Paul?
God, I remember them talking about that. I read that probably 50 years ago or more. And then I guess they must have figured out that there weren't enough stars out there to light it up. But yeah, that was a theory. If it was infinite, it should be daytime all the time. I remember that.
Okay. You're basically asking, why is the sky not white at nighttime? From one point of view, Paul, it is. The sky is white at nighttime. It's an extremely dim white. You can choose a moonless night, and if you're using a sensitive enough light-amplifying optical system, shine that thing around your backyard, and you'll see everything in your backyard as if it was high noon by starlight. All those stars out there are all creating light on the Earth. By human eye standards, it's an extremely dim amount of light. But you use enough light amplification on a night that's not that's got clear sky, not overcast. You can see everything in your backyard with that light amplifying optical system. So, is the sky white at nighttime? The answer is yes. It's a very low level white because the density is so low, Paul. The number of stars per square degree is large, but the area of those stars per square degree is extremely small. With the best telescope, you can't see the details of any one of those stars. So the sky is lit up at nighttime, Paul. You're just not using the right kind of instrumentation. Over to you, Paul, K2LIW.
Very good. I completely forgot about that theory. I remember that. Oh, there's a lot of doctors, but that one I forgot about. That's true. That's what they used to think. Now, here's another one. I still don't like this one. There's as many stars in the sky as there is pieces of sand on this earth. I still don't buy into that one. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, let's back up on that one. Do you think the number of grains of sand on the Earth is a greater or a smaller number than the stars in the sky? Over to you, Paul.
I always said greater, but I never did the math to break it down. You know, I mean, they know how many stars are up there because they know how many galaxies, a couple of billion galaxies, whatever it is. Each one has, you know, maybe 100 billion stars in it, so they can calculate that. I guess we could do the Earth too, but I mean, there's a lot of sand on Earth. Back to you, Dick.
And you and I think at first that the number of grains of sand is a number so big that we call it infinity. Not at all. You and I could go to a beach, scoop up a cup of nice white sand, bring it home, put it under your microscope, and measure the average size of a grain of sand. I don't know what that number is. Maybe it's 1 or 2 thousandths of an inch, the average size of a grain of sand. So, 1 or 2 thousandths of an inch in width, length, and height, you know the volume of that grain of sand. And it's not too difficult to estimate the number of square miles of beachfront we've got across all of our seashores. and you can also make a guess as to how deep the sand goes before you start getting down to rock and other stuff. So you and I can do a rough approximation. Let me drop. Somebody's talking into the wrong mic. I just barely hear them, but...
That's me again.
Okay. We can definitely make a rough estimate as to how many square miles of beach, how many miles deep is the sand, you know, the size of one grain, average grain of sand. Therefore, you and I can come up with a number. And I don't know what the number is. Maybe the number is 10 to the 20. When you take 10 and raise it to the 20 power, that's a huge number. That's one with 20 zeros after it. There's a firm chance that that's the number of grains of sand on the Earth. You and I could estimate that. So it's not infinity, Paul. And when it comes to the number of stars per galaxy, that's an approximation. They could easily be wrong by five times too big or five times too small on this particular galaxy. But you look at enough galaxies, you can come up with an average. You and I can come up with an average for the size of a grain of sand. We can come up with an average for the number of stars in a galaxy. Let me drop. And we can come up with the number of galaxies per square degree. And therefore, we can come up with an approximation of the total number of galaxies. And you multiply it 11, 10 to the 11 times 10 to the 11, 10 to the 22. So, your gut feel may be that the number of grains of sand is much bigger or much smaller. But you and I can estimate that. And we can find out, is it in the right order of magnitude? If we came out with a 10 to 1 error of being equal, astronomically speaking, that's close enough. There's a hell of a lot of things where, if you're just in the right order of magnitude, it'll tell you whether or not something is possible. Let's see what John's got to say. KC2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
Very good, Dick. Well, we know roughly the mass of the Earth and the percentage of it that's sand. Now, look at 10 times 22, the 10 to the 22nd, okay. Imagine taking the grain and weigh it, and then multiply it by that number, and you get an amount of weight. So it may be a lot closer and a lot easier to do it that way, and find out how much mass that would actually be. Be interesting.
And you can go one step further with that estimation, John. Unless you've got an extremely accurate, very small sensing scale, measuring one single grain of sand could be quite difficult. However, with your microscope and your calipers, you can make a pretty good estimation as to how wide, high, and long is that grain of sand. What are the three dimensions? So the volume of that grain of sand, you and I could come up with an estimation that's probably got at least 15% of error to it, but that's close enough. And we make an assumption that that grain of sand is primarily silicon dioxide. And we know the mass of silicon dioxide. So knowing the volume and knowing what it's made out of allows you to estimate its mass, even though measuring it, unless you've got an extremely sensitive scale, I think measuring a grain of sand accurately could be tough. Could be pretty tough. Over to you, John.
Well, we could measure 1,000 grains of sand, or 10,000. We could count that number, and we get a much better average per grain, I think. You know, that might lead somewhere, but that's an interesting thesis.
Okay. So, I can tell by what Paul said. He's convinced the number of grains of sand on the Earth is hugely larger than the number of observable stars in the universe. What's your gut feel, John? The number of grains of sand on the Earth, it's bigger or smaller than the number of stars in the observable universe? Over to you, John.
Crazy as it sounds, I believe that there are less grains of sand than there are stars in the universe. When you look at what we know, how far we can see at this time, we really don't have a good clue. And, you know, that information is coming, and we'll be able to make a better judgment in probably in a short time. Maybe in the next 10 years, they'll be able to reach out much further. I don't think we've seen the end of this universe yet.
10-2-HUH.
HUH, go ahead.
They got the commercial.
do I get a prize? My simple mind is, way of looking at it is, I think the Earth is, compared to the size of the universe, is smaller than a grain of sand.
Run that by again. What's smaller than a grain of sand? The size of the Earth versus the size of the universe? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, that's how my simple mind looks at that, to be able to comprehend it. My guess would be there's more objects, or stars rather, planets, altogether than the sand that's on Earth.
I guarantee you, Andy, if we Google the word number of grains of sand on the Earth, guaranteed there's a Wikipedia that's going to answer that one for you with reasonable accuracy. People have been down that road. So number of grains of sand on planet Earth, guaranteed there's a Wikipedia that's going to tell us that one. It's not going to take very long to do that search. And, somebody's talking into the wrong mic again.
Oh, that's me again. Good job for Wesley, I said.
You want to take that mic that you're talking into by mistake and push it over to one side, John. That's an easy mistake to keep falling into.
Yeah, I have two of those Pro 40s on booms, and one of them's always facing me, so it's just a form of habit.
In the past, were you always using a boom mic, and now you're using a hand mic? So, boom mics are what you've been using for years and years, talking to the TechNet, John?
That's a number, Dick.
Yeah, only boom mics, Dick. They do a good job for me. I don't like these hand mics.
Hey, Paul, what does Wikipedia say is the number of grains of sand on the Earth? What is the number, Paul? Go ahead.
They're a little too exact for me, but 7.5 times 10 to the 18th. Wow. Well, okay, so now you did say 10 to the 22nd for the stars. So the stars would win out, I guess, in this. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, stars are 10 to the 22. You just found out the grains of sand on the Earth is 10 to the 18. 18 versus 22 is 4. 10 to the 4 is 10,000. There's 10,000 times more stars in the observable universe than grains of sand on the Earth. The ratio is 10,000 less grains of sand. Ain't that crazy, Paul? Over to you.
Okay, they have 7.5 times 10 to the 18th, so I'm not sure if that's going to change it much. Looks like it came out of NPR, National Public Radio, probably. Back to you, Dick.
Even if I raised that 7.5 up to 10, that would still be 10 to the 3 different. That's 1,000. So somewhere between 1,000 and 10,000 more stars than grains of sand. The stars win. And that's the observable stars, you could say, today. As John was telling us, he and I are positive. We've only seen a small fraction of the so-called observable universe. I'm fairly sure there are multiverses. You've heard me say so often, we're about to be humbled again. Let me drop. In the early days, mankind assumed the Earth was the center of everything, and that he, capital H, set it up that way, and everything is external to us. Well, we eventually found out we're part of a solar system. And we thought that was the center of everything. Well, the solar system is just one star in a particular galaxy. And we thought that galaxy is everything. Well, that galaxy is part of the local galactic group. We thought that's everything. Well, the local galactic group is one of a whole lot of galactic groups. So we've been humbled 4 or 5 times in a row. We're about to be humbled again. We think we're somewhere in the center of an observable universe. And we think there was just one Big Bang, and we're in the middle of the results of that one Big Bang. For us to think there never was another Big Bang anywhere else. As far as we can see, when you take that ultra-deep field picture with the Hubble Space Telescope, a whole series of pictures, extremely deep field, ultra deep field, whatever, out at the perimeter of that photograph, out of the most distant thing you can see. Let me drop it.
Wikipedia goes 10 to the 21st, a little higher than National Public Radio.
Interesting, but the stars still win. And that's the stars that we know about now, and there's going to be more of them. So, to think that there was only one Big Bang, that there's something magic about this particular Big Bang, and we're the one that's in it, and we're in this one. But out of the perimeter of that ultra-deep field picture, the density of galaxies out there is not decreasing. They're just getting more and more redshifted because they're further and further away, and by the Hubble constant, they're more and more redshifted, they're more and more difficult to see. But the number of them out there doesn't get scarce. If that picture went far enough, you're going to see a hell of a lot more stuff. So, this ain't the end of it. And for us to think we're all there is, and it was all set up just for us, not a chance. Not a chance, from my point of view. And the cosmic microwave background pictures, the CMB, the Wilkinson anisotropy probe, the Planck, all of these probes are starting to see evidence that there's clumpiness out there. Let me drop them. The Big Bang did not give you a nice, completely uniform smear of stuff that left that explosion. And there's gathering evidence among some astrophysicists suggesting that that clumpiness is where you're starting to sense the gravitational field way out there of other universes that are so far away that they're unobservable to us. We can't see them directly, but we can see the gravitational attraction that they're creating. We can't see dark matter, but we can see the gravitational attraction it's creating by the way it's making galaxies revolve in a particular manner. We see strong evidence of dark matter, the gravitational lensing and the rotation of galaxies, rotating more like a wagon wheel rather than a stirring rod in the middle of a paint can, if you know what I mean. In theory, if it was just pure gravity of the stuff that we can see in a galaxy, let me drop. The stars in the center of the galaxy would be rotating much faster than the ones out at the perimeter. But the galaxies that we're observing, they tend to rotate like one great big wagon wheel. That's not following the laws of central force motion that we know about, of, you know, objects in orbit around something else. But there's a distribution of mass there that we're not seeing. Dark energy, dark matter. And so the cosmic microwave background pictures are also showing concentrations. We're seeing the indirect evidence of other universes is one possible interpretation. And who would ever believe that this particular universe is out of the perimeter? It's not slowing down in its expansion. It's accelerating. I say it's accelerating because the stuff out of the perimeter is being sucked away to those other universes that we can't see. And we're starting to see evidence of that in the CMB photographs. That's a bunch of theory. I'm convinced we're about to be humbled again. Anybody have any further questions or comments? K2RIW.
WH2RY, I would just like to make a comment. I'm listening to you talk about, you know, things that are very vast and, you know, almost innumerous as far as counting. Can I make a comment of something I've heard?
He's still out here.
Somebody said he's still out here. Let's go to RYY first. Do these great big numbers make you feel uncomfortable, Joe?
No, but it makes you think. I heard something, I can't remember exactly what show it was on, some sort of scientific show or whatever. And talking about this Enigma machine that was used, if I pronounce it incorrectly, forgive me, that the Germans used during World War II, and if we didn't intercept the code to crack this machine, be able to monitor the conversation that this machine generated, they said the code possibilities of this machine was something like 10 to the 144th power. And they said that number is so large it's equivalent to all the atoms in the universe. And I don't know how they make a calculation like that. I could possibly even guess
come up with a number like that. Back to you.
Quite often I've heard it speculated the number of atoms in the observable universe is 10 to the 70. Every 10 to the 70, every 10 to the 75. The total number of atoms in the observable universe, something like 10 to the 75. So for the total number of permutations and combinations of an Enigma machine, could it really be that big a number? Maybe so, but there's a catch. There's definite syntax, repeated patterns in human speech and spelling. I mean, the E is the most used letter in the English language, for instance. And there's a finite number of two-letter words that are popular, and three-letter words, and so on. There's definite patterns that you can recognize, which cuts down the number of possibilities real fast. If it wasn't for that phenomenon, and repeating messages, and people just using the code book all over again, so to speak, because of the errors and the syntax characteristics, they were able to break the code. When it comes to a Powerball, the total number of chances of Powerball, let me drop a code. I think Powerball, the total number of chances is 219,331,000,000. I may be off by an order of magnitude here, but I was skeptical of that, and I looked up what Powerball is, where they've got, is it five balls? Yeah, I think either four or five balls numbered from 1 to 69, and then the last ball is 1 to 24. And when you go through the permutations, you come up with exactly that number, the 219 million, I think it is. 219,331,221, something like that, is the chances. And so when they were up to the maximum number of dollars recently for that prize, in theory, you could buy a ticket with every possible number and you're guaranteed to win. On paper, that sounds good. How in the world? I mean, if every single Powerball ticket selling store, let me drop a ticket, is selling tickets 24/7 as fast as they can, they can't manufacture that number of tickets. So even if you were organized enough so there's no duplicates of numbers and you and your crew of people are making sure you buy every number, they can't do it. I'm hearing somebody on the input that's not coming through the machine that's trying to check in. Who is that person? K2LIW listening. I heard him say something, something number. Say that again. Okay, Avogadro's number. 6.023×10^23. That's the total number of atoms in 1 gram mole of a gas. An ideal gas has a known number of atoms. I think it's Avogadro's number. It's 10^23 power. So these numbers are all very large, but calculatable. That number is small compared to the number of atoms in the universe, something like 10^70. My Hewlett-Packard calculator has the maximum number of 10^449. Call it 249. Call it 250. 10^250 as a positive number, 10^250, and 10^-450. I can handle some pretty big numbers. And you can't come anywhere near using that number. Every calculator, every digital calculator, has an overflow and underflow characteristic. In other words, beyond a certain number, the number is bigger than you can represent in your calculator. Let me drop. And if you go in the small direction, that's called the underflow, there's a number so small, 10^-450, can't go to the 10^-451. So there's a small number on the left-hand side you can't go below. There's a large number on the right-hand side you can't go above. But you can cover everything in between. For most situations, that's good enough. Believe it or not, there are certain kinds of matrix mathematics where the error accumulates in such a way that as big as those numbers are, it's not quite big enough. Ain't that crazy? K2RIW listening.
WS2N.
I think Powerball is something like 292 million, approximately 292 million to one is your chance of winning. But three people did do it, didn't they? So, how about that?
Yep. What's double WS2N?
Go ahead, Paul.
Oh, I'm still back with the galaxies. When you're talking about the spin of the galaxies, I don't know if you read the book. It's an old book now, but it's called The Astronomers. It has somebody by the name of Vera Rubin in there who discovered the staring at the catalogs of pictures taken of the galaxy and figured out basically what you were saying before, that the stars weren't rotating part of it as properly as they should have been predicted to. And indirectly, you know, she really was discovering the dark matter. So, but that's a good book if anybody ever wants to read that. Yeah, you get a hold of The Astronomers. It gives you a good layout of all the people that were really involved. All these, the foundations of a lot of things that we were involved with today back in there.
Yep. You look back in the past records and the evidence was there. People just didn't put it together just right. 229 million, was it, or 219? I think it's 229 million total number of chances in Powerball. And the total population of people using Powerball, let's see, if every man, woman, and child in the United States was doing it, it's what, 320 million. Some people are buying a fairly large number of tickets. So, has anyone ever quoted the total number of tickets that are sold, Powerball tickets? Has anyone ever come up with that number, to your knowledge, Joe? W2RYY, K2RIW.
W2BZ.
W2BZ, that is your name, sir, and tell us your comment. My name is Dick, K2RIW.
Ms. Rich, and I checked in like a couple of months ago, and I think it was Eric and I discovered with new John Godfrey at WNET, and I have to add, well, I have a real good comment. I guess I should let it drop. I'm on a new phone, and I'm not very versed in Echolink anyway, so I don't know. Maybe it's okay to keep it going for a second. I'm in Stony Brook Medical Center, up 15 floors with a clear view of everything. You know, Connecticut, you know, it's just nothing as high as this place I'm on. And I always wondered, if you have to, I'm talking about HF now, if you have to operate from way high like I am now, but inside a building, how much are you actually giving up? Is it so much that you're giving up because this antenna is not on, let's say, a platform right out of the window, you know, in free air? I always wondered what the trade-offs were for incredible height versus being enclosed. Back to you, Dick, W2BZ.
Rich, the word enclosed is a very relative set of words. You and I can be sitting in the middle of a 707 or 747 airliner, one of the center seats, with a handy-talkie. And if they gave you permission, you can legally key up that handy-talkie and light up a whole lot of repeaters. You think you're in an enclosure. That RF energy goes squirting out of those windows pretty nicely. It's getting attenuated somewhat. You transmit a radio signal. It goes to every possible cubic centimeter of this universe. You can't stop it from doing that. I'll admit that in certain directions you've got hills and buildings and water towers and things that are a blockage, and it's giving you some attenuation, but the signal never goes to zero. Obvious by the Voyager spacecraft out there at 120 astronomical units. Let me drop them.
We're up to 133.
133 astronomical units, and is that something like 8 billion miles or is it 12 billion miles? I keep forgetting the number, Paul. Go ahead.
I
tried to keep track of the AU's mileage is just too unwieldy. I could look up kilometers, they have that. But, mileage, you're better off just doing AU's, I think, Dick.
But it's a big number, something like 8 billion miles, 134 astronomical units, something like a 6-watt transmitter. At the speed of light, when NASA talks to that, it sends up a signal saying, hey, how Voyager, how you doing? And the Voyager answers immediately, things are fine. It takes 17 hours at the speed of light for the signal to get there one way, another 17 hours for the reply to come back, so a round-trip minimum communication is 34 hours, 34, 35 hours. You would think that that's impossible. It's the longest range thing that human beings have ever launched into space. And we're still talking to that, and they predict we're going to be able to keep talking to it until the year 1922, down to something like 6 watts of output at 8.5 gigahertz, 8 billion miles away. So that radio signal goes everywhere. Let me drop. Now, you and I on 2 meters, in order to be well heard at a good distance, because a 2-meter signal gets attenuated very rapidly by trees. You hold your handy talkie in the middle of a forest, and you'd be lucky if somebody can hear you a mile away. Put that handy talkie on top of the, at the window of the space shuttle with astronaut Owen Garriott flying over northern Texas, 1,600 miles away, and I'm listening on a whip antenna on the top of my, a mag mount antenna on the top of my automobile in the parking lot of AIL, 1,600 miles away, and he's 15 dB out of my noise. 1,600 miles away, a 5-watt handy-talkie, and I'm hearing him. That exact same handy-talkie would have trouble talking a mile away if you and I are in the woods. So therefore, if you want good coverage on 2 meters, you can take the rattiest old antenna in the world. Let me drop a coat hanger antenna, soldered together on an SO239, and you mount that in the attic or on the chimney of your house, and bring a lossy piece of RG58 cable down into the living quarters and connect it to your handy-talkie. So you unplug the rubber duck, and you plug in that piece of RG58 going to that, let me call it a $2 antenna on the chimney of your house, and you will be 20 decibels stronger. 20 decibels is a 100-to-1 ratio. As if your 5-watt handy-talkie suddenly went to 500 watts. That's what you would sound like. So no matter where your antenna is mounted, there's always a better place where you can put it to talk from point A to point B. But even if you don't put it in a better place, if you're using the right technique, like the techniques being used by the Deep Space Network, they're listening to a signal, but when you calculate how strong that signal is, you'd say, hey, that's impossible. It's a very low data rate. They're using a receiver that is 50 hertz wide. They're getting 50 bits per second from 8 billion miles away, but they're doing it. W2BZ, K2RAW in the TechNet.
K2RAW in the TechNet, W2BZ. Let me just clarify a little bit more. Let's say if the floor of my hospital room here, okay, I decide to make into the very roof of this big medical center and construct now in free air, construct a tower, you know, and a beam, just as you would do it, quote unquote, normally. And I'm still at this height I'm at, the advantage, the height advantage. Now, though, it's sitting on the roof with no enclosed hospital room. Doesn't matter about the medical equipment. I'm just talking about an apartment building. Let's call it an apartment building. Would putting that in a freestanding air on top of the roof now, not my room floor, but a roof now, operating, you know, down the hall someplace, wherever, would that so, I'm talking just HF, too. Just face up. Would that so incredibly improve what I could do now where I can open a window and, you know, figure out what kind of antenna I could shoot out the window, but with clear view all the way to Massachusetts. Who knows? That's the question. How much am I losing by not being able to mount the antenna on a roof, you know, a Yagi, whatever, as it normally could? I could just, it's an indoor antenna, but up a long, long way. I've always wondered about that bit. Go ahead, K2RWWTPZ.
And there's a lot of ambiguity in the question that you're asking here, Rich. Are you asking if I mount a tower on top of the building, I can either use my antenna on the top of the building, or I can mount a tower on top of the building, raise the antenna to a greater height, so assume you put up 100 feet of tower, so I raise the antenna another 100 feet on top of the building, and put a transmission line to that antenna, and feed the higher antenna. That's one question you could be asking. The wording you used made it sound like you're just setting up the tower as a potential transmitting antenna, but you're not connecting anything to it. Is it making a difference? I'm not sure which question you're asking. Over to you, Rich, K2LAW.
Yeah, no, neither one. I'm just saying, not raising up the antenna at all. Let's say I had a PR-33 Junior or whatever, right on the floor in my hospital room, okay? And I'm up this high. I see the Shoreham tanks, I think, the Shoreham stacks, I think that's what they are out there. They're even lower than where I am. So I'm not moving the antenna. All I'm doing is cutting the building around it away. So I maintain the same exact height for the antenna, but now it doesn't have any structure around it. That's what I'm trying to say. And it doesn't matter if run the transmission line to, two doors down, two rooms down, or three rooms down. It's just to get, the electronics out of where this antenna is. And with a magic wand, I could take all the structure around it. I'm just trying to see, how much do you lose by not being able to have an antenna at the same height, at this height? How much height advantages do you lose? Because it can't be, it's not out at the same height on top of the building. That's as clear as I can get. Maybe not too clear this time of Sunday. All right, Dick.
Sounds like he's talking about the building attenuation by itself.
Yeah, that's what he's finally used enough words that I've finally figured out. He's asking how much attenuation are you getting from the building? And that's, there's five different answers depending on what frequency you're on. At HF frequencies, what I think is the construction of your medical center is such that I think you're only getting 1 or 2 dB of insertion loss because of the building. If it was on 450 megacycles, I think the building attenuation, the walls of the building, you've got to go through a number of walls to finally get out into the free air. I think that signal could be attenuated by 15 dB, round numbers, at 450 megacycles. So your building has different attenuations at different frequencies, depending on which direction you want to transmit, how many walls you got to go through. People have done that evaluation there, Rich. They have measured the insertion loss of buildings. And if you really wanted to, you could find the right article and give you a pretty good estimation. W2BZ, K2LAW.
Yeah, I know it's, different types of buildings that would have different attenuation and absorption and all that, and you lose whatever, omnidirectional you have, because, I'm on one side of the building. It's a huge, I was in the city, and I once talked to you guys with my handy talkie. I was up 30 floors on 68th Street and 2nd Avenue in my apartment, and trying to fool with a artificial ground, which I have no idea what it was for. It didn't improve anything, and I couldn't read anything good about it, but I had one. And it just was so discouraging to be able to, again, see over most of the buildings looking north in Manhattan, and not being able to work out really great with my 480, I keep up 480. So sorry to. One other thing on a humane level about these fantastic Powerball numbers. I have a friend who has a smoke shop on the North Fork of Long Island, and so I sit with her and once in a while, and we BS with the constant flow of regular customers, and it's the saddest parade of people I've ever seen in my life. Jimmy Greek, Jimmy the Greek, when he was still listened to, I'll never forget it. He said, that is the, sadly, he said, it's tragic. Any of those bets are the biggest sucker bets on the planet Earth. And the people who could least afford it are the ones that are suckered the easiest. And I see these people. I know them now. There's one guy that comes in every day with a whole system, a pouch, and he, you know, drops $80, $90, $100 a day, and, you know, he's down $40,000, $50,000. He's an electrician. And it's the human side of it that really is disturbing. Anyway, guys, I'll sit back and listen like I've been doing since I was WN2BZZ in Bayside. So, back to you, Dick. W2BZ.
Yeah, if you look at the Foxwood operation and these other gambling casinos, if you understand mathematics, every single one of those games has a given percentage of house advantage. I mean, we're talking about a $500 million installation. Who's paying for that? The customers. The people walking through the front door say today, I feel lucky. What the hell does that mean? You sit at any one of those gambling tables for a long enough period of time, they're going to take all your money. There's no choice. With a couple of very rare exceptions, just to set off all the horns and whistles and make everybody excited, thinking that, oh boy, there's a winner. That machine was just a winner. But there's a given house advantage. And then every time you, let's assume that the house advantage is 5%. So 5% of your money, on average, is being subtracted every time you play the game. Play the game long enough, you multiply 5% enough times, they're going to take your money. It's a fool's game. Any of these gambling games really are a fool's game. If you understand mathematics, you wouldn't do it. You guys have been listening to, that was a bunch of opinions, TechNet number 1586. And you heard TechNet and Space Report number 185. You've had enough snowy day today. enough snow shoveling, enough snow blowing. I'm ready to call it a day. John, though, he stays up pretty late. He's just getting wound up for some of his deeper experiments in his laboratory. KC2WGB, K2RIW. Go ahead, John. John, wrong mic again, and this time you were further away from the hand mic so that you were down audio-wise 15 dB.
Just a creature of habit for sure. Can't correct things easily at my age, but that's all. I can excuse, I'm old. I would like to thank everybody for joining the net and for submitting the questions. Always enjoy them, and we'll see you all again next week if everything goes well. So have fun and be kind to each other. KC2WGB.
Make a rough guess, John. How long is it going to take to melt that snow that's in your driveway? The foot and a half, I'm guessing.
My driveway, which is 70 feet long, 25 feet wide, has a 4-foot drift of snow for about 40 foot of the driveway, so that's going to take a couple of days, I'm sure. But I'm going to just sit back, relax, and watch the snow melt, Dick. I'm not going to move it, that's for sure.
You're lucky you don't have to walk through that, John.
Yeah, my front door is clearing. The sidewalk is right down to the bare concrete. That worked out beautifully. So front's okay, back is a little problem. I'm not going to worry about it. Dick, enjoy. Paul, good night. And everyone out there, have fun.
Bye-bye for now, John. Thank you.
Good evening, Dick. And I will come on the TechNet next week with an interesting antenna question. Bye-bye for now.
I'm looking forward to it, John. I mean, Joe, I'm being called away right now.
W2YY.
N2XJN, KC2WGB.
with that?
Well, Joe, I have it almost finished. I haven't been able to work outside, though. It's getting a little too cold to do that, so I'll probably be doing the testing in the spring since it warms up a little bit. Maybe we'll have an early break. But I think it's going to work well. I'm still trying to procure a preamp for maybe something up to 20 gig, something I can mount outside right next to the antenna, and feed that information into my lab. That'd be nice to play with.
Oh, very good. Well, there's something to look forward to.
Yeah, I got a long list of projects on a sheet here that I, when I get around to them, I attempt to do something. There's always something to do, but, you know, I take it easy. I'm not in a rush. Not that I'm going to discover anything different, but it's fun to play.
Okay, very good. Very good. Just kind of curious.
Boy, this repeater was really very quiet today and yesterday. Spooky, eerie quiet. I was monitoring a few times just in case somebody needed some help or something, but boy, there was nobody out. With the ban on the road, I guess that was one of the brightest things the city did, well, the state did, ban all the traffic so they could clean the mess up. Should be fairly easy traveling tomorrow.
Yeah, for those that have to travel, right. They were saying that hopefully, like at the LIRR trains running for Monday morning, that's going to make a lot of unhappy people if they don't.
Yeah, especially people going into Manhattan, because Manhattan, from what I understand, friends of mine tell me it's wide open already. No problem getting around, and everything seems to be working.
Well, they got about 5 or 6 hours to accomplish that task, and after that, they'll have a lot of irate customers.
Yeah, you know, I feel sorry a little bit for the small business guys that have those little, I don't know, coffee shops and bodegas and stuff that are in the city, and they were shut down, and they were all crying. I mean, they lost hundreds and hundreds of dollars, but, you know, you got to have that in the program as you're developing the business. So, but they're so used to that deluge every day that when they don't get it, they miss it.
Well, I guess it's something you have to learn to, you know, to expect it. That they have a small business, they only have that many people per day coming in. If you have a large impacting event in your equation, like a major snowstorm that you don't see very often, yeah, that's going to whack you pretty good.
Stevie Z? How recognized. You know, Joe, what I think is going to happen, any hint of a storm that's going to be, say, over 6 inches, I think the city is going to ban traffic for that day so that they can get a jump, so that the following days they're not dealing with the chaos with the sanitation trucks and all the cars. You know, these idiots that can't drive go out and get stuck, then they can't plow the roads. I think that's going to become a normal function for a snowstorm. They're just going to tell you, can't go out. Might be good. Hal, pick it up, sir. KC2, WGB.
Well, B, KC2, WGB, KC3, Zodiac Group. I'm just on my way back. I was down Brooklyn. I had to take a friend of mine back, and going back towards Oceanside. The roads aren't too bad. Be a lot better, I imagine, tomorrow. So, go ahead, John. Pick it up, KC6DVZ.
Yeah, from what I understand, even Tuesday is going to be in the 40s. So I think the snow will disappear quickly. I just hope that the drains are cleared where, as it melts, it won't wind up freezing at night. That'll be another issue, but the soldiers will be out, so I don't think it'll be a problem.
Station, pick it up. Well, that in the air station, John.
That was Joe, RYY. May have gotten a phone call or something to in and out. No problem. All right, I'm going to go back to what I was doing. You have a great night, or morning, I should say. And I'll talk to you on Donald Lock, sir.
Okay, John. You get a chance to give me a call, but I want to talk to you on the phone. I'll tell you something, don't you?
Okay, I'll see what time I get out of here and get into the house where I can access the phone.
Oh, it's going to be within the next half hour, fine. So I'll talk to you tomorrow if you get a chance.
All right, understood. No problem. KC2, WGB clear.
230 Purple Zombies, clear.